We demand justice and compensation for their families.
The commemoration of martyrs comes as the Afghanistan situation is still tense for journalists. Rights bodies are calling for support and protection by the ruling Taliban and the international community. Due to war and insecurity, Afghanistan has been one of the most dangerous countries for reporters. And there have been journalists like Press TV's martyrs who gave their lives in the line of duty. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Rating agency Moody's has recently changed its ratings outlook on Italy's banking system from stable to negative. Business conditions for Italy's banks are expected to further worsen in the coming 12 to 18 months, especially with regard to the quality of their loans and earnings. The news broke at the heels of a series of downgrades in medium-term growth forecasts by the Bank of Italy, the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, Employers Association Confindustria, and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development.
We will hold a highly important cabinet meeting on Friday, during which we will discuss new budgetary targets as the government is racing against time to draft the 2023 budget law.
Italy's statistical agency ISTAT has predicted that the Italian economy will be flat in 2023 after growth of around 3 to 3.5% this year. Moody's forecast was even more cautious, predicting 2.7% growth for this year as a whole and zero growth next year.
The challenges for Italy go well beyond economic growth. Prices have reached record highs lately, with the country's annual inflation rate hitting almost 12% in October and energy costs still out of control. In addition to that, the euro's weakness with respect to the American dollar has significantly eroded the purchasing power of the Italians.
Milk, bread, pasta, all these basic items cost much more now. I'm very worried.
When you go grocery shopping, but also when you buy fuel or are faced with paying exorbitant energy bills, everything seems to be out of control. That said, I am pretty sure that they are not telling us the truth about what's really going on.
On Thursday, Italy's new far-right Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni travelled to Brussels to meet with the leaders of European Union institutions for the first time. In the Belgian capital, Meloni held two meetings with the President of the European Parliament, Roberta Metsola, and EU Commissioner for Economy, Paolo Gentiloni, in which her main ask was reportedly greater joint EU efforts to cope with energy costs. Max Civili, Rome.
An attack on the convoy of ousted Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan wounded him and several of his supporters who were marching towards Islamabad demanding early elections. Police said that a gunman opened fire at the campaign truck carrying Imran Khan, wounding him slightly. Since his ouster in a parliamentary no-confidence vote in April, Khan has been alleging that his dismissal was a conspiracy engineered by his successor Shahbaz Sharif and the United States. The PTI leadership has directly blamed Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif, Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah, and a high-ranking military official for carrying out the assassination attempt.
We demand that these three men should be removed from their posts. If these people are not removed from their positions, then there will be nationwide protests.
While asking Imran Khan's supporters to stop the blame game, the government has assured every possible support for holding high-profile inquiry into the assassination attempt.
The incident is very unfortunate and condemnable, but it should not be politicized, and speculations on this incident must be avoided.
Political experts believe that the attack on the PTI party chief will trigger further political instability and chaos in the country.
I think in the days to come, the Pakistani political atmosphere will be more charged. It will be more violent. This gun attack on Khan will definitely change Pakistan's political scenario.
The attack on the former Pakistani premier also sparked countrywide protest and international condemnations.
The attack on the former Pakistani prime minister has further fueled the ongoing political tensions. It is highly believed that more confrontations would be witnessed in days to come in the country's political arena. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The United States has entered its last week before the midterm legislative vote, and tensions are starting to escalate. The Republicans appear certain to win the lower House of Representatives and need to win only one of four now neck-and-neck races to also control the upper Senate. Some Democrats have called the polls Republican propaganda, further undermining confidence in their predictions and creating more uncertainty.
I think it should just be positive. It's very hard to decide what is the truth and what isn't. You get the one candidate, and then the next candidate says everything that the first candidate said is wrong on the commercial. We've started muting them.
Perhaps the most telling poll is one which showed that a whopping 79% of Americans believe that the country is out of control. Many say there's no lack of reasons for such a perception. The specter of a divided and thus ineffective federal government, record inflation, a prolonged drug epidemic, regular mass shootings, a likely double-dip recession, fear-mongering about war with Russia over Ukraine or with China over Taiwan, a cultural war over identity politics, and more.
Perception is reality, right? So, when we see the political attacks that have happened on both sides, it kind of gives that impression. I think the media can feed into that at times as well. I think that's a pretty accurate assessment of where we're at, unfortunately.
The recent in-home attack on the husband of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who holds the number three post in the American system, has become embroiled in salacious controversy. Similar to the Hunter Biden laptop affair in the autumn of 2020, the case is dominating the pre-vote headlines and producing partisan allegations of either misinformation or a cover-up. Since 2017, the number of investigated threats against Washington's lawmakers has tripled. Perhaps the biggest problem in the United States hasn't even occurred yet, the near certainty of disputed election results. Some tight Senate races may require runoff votes, meaning the final outcome will likely be controversial for weeks. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The UK government has abandoned plans to create a working definition of Islamophobia in a move which has come under heavy fire from critics. Back in May 2019, the then government headed by Theresa May agreed it would seek to establish an Islamophobia definition to get a firmer grip of this bigotry and division. But following mounting frustration over a lack of progress on the issue, the effort has now been reportedly ditched.
The news is hardly surprising, as May's successor, Boris Johnson, has been faulted many times over for saying Islamophobic things, whilst other Tory ministers have also been accused of being deeply Islamophobic themselves.
Reappointed Communities Secretary Michael Gove has been a long-time critic of so-called political Islam, and condemned attempts to define Islamophobia as a danger for free speech.
Michael Gove, while he was at Policy Exchange, was very much supportive of anything which, as far as he was concerned, outed Islam. He calls it political Islam. But actually, in reality, it's a phobia which these folk have about any kind of Muslim. When you look at and compare it to how they deal with anti-Semitism, and they're so absolutely hell-bent on definitions, on laws, on rooting out, on chasing, hunting down, witch-hunting anybody who even sniffs the idea of something to do with Jewry, or even say the J word, or even to raise the issue of Zionism, for instance, or to criticize Israel. As soon as you do these things, as far as these neoconservatives are concerned, you are enemy number one.
Islamophobia is a serious problem across Britain. Muslims being the most frequently targeted group for religious hate crimes in England and Wales. Defining Islamophobia could provide new powers to combat anti-Muslim hate. But with a string of scandals having exposed anti-Muslim bigotry within the ruling party itself, Conservatives just don't seem willing to risk shooting themselves in the foot on the issue. Robert Carter, London.
In a narrow alley in the Itaewon Entertainment District of Seoul, more than 150 people suffocated and died in the crush of a crowd on a Halloween Saturday evening. 26 of them were foreigners. 5 of those were Iranian, the most of any foreign nationals, exchange students in their 20s and 30s. This week, the lives lost in the Itaewon tragedy are being mourned with white chrysanthemums and black ribbons. And as the investigation into what happened begins, tough questions are being asked of the government and of the police about what more could have been done to prevent such a disaster. As video and news of the event has circulated in both mass and social media, frustration at the response of the government and police has swelled.
Our country is not even at war. Whose fault is it for this to happen? Why were they so careless? Where were the police? This tragedy wouldn't have happened if the police had controlled traffic with a little effort. What are you going to do after killing all those young people?
South Korean Prime Minister Han Duck-soo appeared before the foreign press Tuesday. He suggested South Korea was still one of the safest countries in the world and that preparations were inadequate in part because the event was not registered. But he admitted some failures.
The real issue was some deficiencies in our crowd management. That kind of deficiencies in our system should have been corrected long before, but it's a reality that it hasn't been done, and at least we should not pass that away again.
The Itaewon tragedy is South Korea's worst disaster since 2014, when a ferry sank, killing 304 people, most of them students on a field trip. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A group of Iranians, among them war veterans, gathered in front of the German embassy in Tehran to protest against the German government for Berlin's role in the recent riots in Iran. The protesters, including ordinary people and veterans of the 8-year Iraqi-imposed war on Iran in the 1980s, carried placards and chanted slogans against the German government for its record of supporting former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and its role in the recent unrest in Iran.
A number of my comrades and friends became handicapped and some were martyred in the war because of the enemy's chemical attacks. Documents that have been released reveal that Germany had provided Saddam with raw materials for chemical bombs. Therefore, we are to say that we do not allow Germany to interfere in the internal affairs of our country anymore. We hold Germany responsible for instigating unrest in Iran.
The demonstrators also vented their anger on the German chancellor and foreign minister.
I am taking part in this protest gathering to condemn the German government for its interventionist stance towards Iranian affairs. We know that Germany and other EU member states, by supporting riots and unrest in Iran, are only after their own vested interests, and they do not truly care about Iranian people.
On Monday, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman criticized Germany for its unconstructive initiative to classify the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps as a terrorist organization. Condemning Germany's move as an irresponsible measure, Nasser Kanani said Tehran hopes that the governments of Germany and other governments would take account of the outcome of their unconstructive measures.
Iranian officials believe that repeating such an approach by Germany and other EU member states towards Iran, which is based on miscalculations and misinformation, will once again expose the Union to failure. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
In more than 900 cities nationwide, Iranians from all walks of life took to the streets on Friday, November the 4th, to mark National Students' Day, the anniversary of the U.S. Embassy takeover, which is also called the National Day Against Global Arrogance. In the capital, Tehran, masses gathered in the streets leading to the building that used to be the U.S. Embassy in Iran before the Islamic Revolution. They chanted slogans expressing their anger and frustration with U.S. hostile policies towards the Islamic Republic of Iran.
We have come here to show our support for our leader in the face of enemies of our country, including the U.S.
Our presence today shows the U.S. that the nation is vigilant and we will not bow down to U.S. plots.
Considering the recent riots, it was even more important for me to take part in the rally this year. We have to show to the world that we love Iran and we support the Islamic Republic.
We are here and it's literally, we are coming onto the streets 43 years. You cannot find any more democratic country than Iran. What's the turnout of elections in Europe, in the West? They're supposed to be like the civilization and democracy, land of democracy. What's the turnout of their election? Look at all these people. These are coming by themselves.
Every year on the 13th day of the Iranian month of Aban, the Iranian nation, particularly students, hold rallies across the country to mark Students' Day. But this year's rallies come amid violent foreign-backed riots in the country, which have claimed the lives of dozens of people and security forces.
What's significant about this year's 13th of Aban or Students' Day demonstrations is the fact that the younger generation taking part in masses to send their message to the world, in particular, many young ladies taking part in this year's demonstration.
The U.S. should know that we have chosen to wear our hijab and no one can force us to take it off.
Our hijab is a symbol of our religion and our faith. Our country is an Islamic country and this is the way we choose to live.
In a statement, the demonstrators pledged allegiance to the Islamic Republic and the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei. They also called on authorities to address people's legitimate demands and also draw a line between peaceful protesters and rioters. Kisumi Shah Ahmadi, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Since Mohammed bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's crown prince in 2017, the kingdom has detained hundreds of activists and human rights defenders, as well as bloggers, academics and others for their political activism, showing nearly zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnation of the crackdown on these people. Muslim scholars, particularly Shiite clerics and human rights activists from the Shia communities, have been executed, and women's rights campaigners have been imprisoned and tortured as freedom of expression, relationship between groups and their beliefs continue to be denied by the Saudi authorities. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The English website of Fast News Agency reports, an international human rights organization warned against the appalling conditions of human rights in Saudi Arabia and the brutal forms of physical and mental torture that state authorities use against imprisoned political dissidents and pro-democracy campaigners. The European Saudi Organization for Human Rights said in a report that Saudi citizens are subject to all kinds of torture ever since they're arrested under trumped-up charges, and the torments do not stop even after rulings are passed and include the families and relatives of the detainees as well. The group added that Saudi officials carry out various types of mental and physical torture against the detainees who later face the death penalty. They are severely beaten and forcibly disappeared for long periods of time during detention. The European Saudi Organization for Human Rights went on to note that Saudi authorities make use of different methods of physical torture, including electric shocks, sleep deprivation, beatings, extraction of nails from fingers, and hanging from the feet to force the imprisoned activists into signing confessions. The human rights organization pointed to the case of Saudi teenager Mustafa al-Darwish, who was executed in June of 2021 and was forced to sign a confession under the threat of a retrial. Apart from physical torture, the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights has observed the use of psychological torture against a number of detainees, including threats to their families. Haider Al-Leif, a protester who was executed on 23rd of April 2019, was threatened that if he did not sign the confession, his wife would be summoned to prison to divorce him. According to the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights, detainees endure other brutal measures, such as deprivation of contact with their families and daily insults. In many cases, torture results in permanent disability, in injury, pain, coma, and loss of consciousness. The Saudi prisoners are denied the right to medical treatment. The report added that Munir al-Adam, a young man who was executed along with 36 other men on 23rd of April 2019, lost his hearing because of torture, and Abdullah al-Tarif, another young man who was executed in the same mass execution, was also tortured. Torture caused damage to Abdullah al-Tarif's spinal vertebrae, as well as deviation of his left eye, and other parts of his body were also harmed. Agence France-Presse explains more about the same story. A Saudi court of law has sentenced 10 Egyptian men for up to 18 years for trying to organize a remembrance event for the 1973 Arab-Israeli war between the Tel Aviv regime and a coalition of Arab states led by Egypt and Syria. Two relatives speaking on condition of anonymity for fear of reprisals said that the court found the men from Nubian ethnic group guilty of establishing a terrorist group. The Egyptian men were first arrested in October of 2019 for trying to organize the event. They were released without charge in December of that year, but were rearrested the following July. The relatives of the men said, "I have intense anger at the extreme injustice to which our people have been subjected." The relative said one man received an 18-year sentence, one was jailed for 16 years, two were jailed for 14 years, and the others for between 10 and 12 years. Human rights groups had previously campaigned for the men's release and denounced the proceedings against them as a travesty of justice. They said the men were being prosecuted for the peaceful exercise of their right to freedom of expression in trying to organize a community event. Activists said the men had been denied regular family contact and only allowed access to government-appointed lawyers, and that at least two of the men are elderly and in a state of poor health. The relative said three of the men are over 60 years old. Prominent human rights group Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies, in a Twitter post, denounced recent sentences as harsh. Democracy for the Arab World Now, a US-based advocacy organization, also said the rulings were unfair. The report comes amid Saudi Arabia's back-channel attempts to normalize diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime. The website of Middle East Eye covers the same story, but from a different angle. A group of human rights advocates voiced concern that the British government may be complicit in human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia, citing lack of clarity over what the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund supports in the kingdom. In a report published recently, some campaigners said that at a time when the human rights situation is deteriorating in Saudi Arabia, uncertainty about what the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund is supporting in the kingdom raises questions about whether Britain is bolstering institutions involved in the abuses. The report added that the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund, which has so far given £70 million to six Persian Gulf states, has been criticised by members of parliament and by human rights groups for leaving the public largely in the dark about how it is run and taxpayer money is spent. The latest report comes as women's rights are removed from a description of what the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund supports in Saudi Arabia, a week after Riyadh sentenced a Leeds University student and women's rights activist to 34 years in prison for following and retweeting the critics of the kingdom on Twitter. In June of last year, the British government published the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund's supports, saying it bolsters the strategic partnership and delivers mutual prosperity and security by supporting Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030 reforms across priority sectors in line with British values, including women's rights. But in the Saudi Arabia section of the news summary published on 26th of August, a week after Salma al-Shahab's 34-year prison sentence over her tweets made headlines, women's rights are no longer referenced at all. Lina al-Hathloul, head of monitoring and communications for the human rights group, Al-Aqst, said the newly published summary still doesn't provide clear and transparent answers and questioned how the Persian Gulf Strategic Fund is supporting human rights in Saudi Arabia. Dana Ahmad, West Asia and Persian Gulf researcher at Amnesty International, described the fund extremely concerning, saying Saudi Arabia's dire human rights record of silencing dissenting voices, executing individuals and ruthlessly crushing basic human rights of citizens and residents needs to be thoroughly addressed.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Political violence in the U.S. has reached epic proportions due to the polarization in the country. One example, the U.S. President Joe Biden has accused his predecessor Donald Trump and his supporters of undermining democracy ahead of next week's midterm elections. Some Republican candidates have said that they may refuse to accept the outcome should they lose. This comes on top of the most recent act of violence against the husband of the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who was attacked with a hammer. How have U.S. politics reached a point where politicians are threatening each other and Americans are acting out violently?
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Activist and commentator Don DeBarge joins us from Austin, New York. Also joining us is journalist and author Daniel Lazar, also joining us from New York.
Okay, welcome to you both. So we are continuing this U.S. political violence theme in another episode of our program, and we deemed it to be that important, and I mentioned that in the last time we had that to both of you, because there were some revelations that were unprecedented in a sense, which is not associated in the mainstream outside of the U.S., perhaps, in terms of the depth of what this really means. So we had this attack, Daniel Lazar, first start with you, where you had Nancy Pelosi's husband, and I remember last time I made a mistake saying axe. Anyways, he was hit with a hammer. But the person who was looking for her, for the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, of which he said that he would injure her. Now the question comes about: is this just a lone incident of somebody, an American, acting out in this form and manner, which is obviously very violent?
Well, it's hard to say, but it's definitely, there's no question that tempers are rising, that tensions are increasing. There is a huge degree of polarization. People are very angry, and there's a great deal of, you know, talk of violence in the air. I mean, after all, on January 6, 2021, we had a mob invade Washington. Four or five people were killed. The mob, you know, members of the mob chanted, you know, "Where is Nancy? Where is Nancy?" Nancy Pelosi is a polarizing figure. And they engage in a great deal of destruction and would likely have killed Nancy Pelosi if they'd gotten their hands on her. Probably is the same thing true for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others. So, you know, there's a real danger of violence because the machinery of government is breaking down, and as it breaks down, anger and frustration are increasing on all sides.
Don DeBarge, isn't it a far cry, though, to have people, average Americans, in a matter of speaking, act out against politicians in a way? Well, I guess they mentioned the January 6 incident that happened there on Capitol Hill. For them to come out and want to kill their lawmakers, the U.S. politicians, how should one view that?
Well, let's look at it through the prism of the editorial pages of the New York Times in July 2018, where after Donald Trump met with Vladimir Putin to try to calm relations between the two countries, accused Trump of treason, and there were calls for him to be prosecuted for that, which, by the way, carries the death penalty. Let's start there. This is something that's been tracked. At Pew Research, for example, did a study in 2014 looking at the period from 1994 to 2014, and shows the entrenchment of this polarization, where large chunks of people on the left and right, quote unquote, these terms are really kind of meaningless right now, but the liberal and conservative are the terms they used in their study of the Democratic and Republican parties, respectively, how the number of Democrats that identified as liberal and Republicans that identified as conservatives had grown and hardened. The phenomenon really didn't begin in 1994. It began much earlier, of course. I remember the presidential election in 1980, for example. At the time, however, Democrats that identified as liberals were, among other things, anti-war, for example. One of the big fears of Reagan being elected in 1980 was that he would start a war with the Soviet Union. here we are with someone who everyone calls in the political economy here a liberal, Joe Biden, is actually at war with Russia. You know, there's a lot of stuff to really sort of plod through here. There's just one last point, because I want clarity on this from the last conversation that we had. You know, Dan correctly referred to the fact that there is this other process where if there's a block, basically if the vote from each state at the joint session in January 6th is rejected, then the electors are chosen by a different mechanism than, you know, than, in other words, not voted on by the House members, but rather by people that are selected to do that job. As a matter of fact, you would never get there because you would first have votes in each of the two chambers on the challenges, and in each of those cases, those votes would be conducted in houses of Congress that had Democratic majorities on January 6, 2021. So the idea that somehow that insurrection was tied to a strategy for a coup d'etat, really, it just falls.
Okay, very well. Let's look at how long this has been going on, this term political violence, and, of course, the way that it has now really brought into the fore, Daniel Lazar. I mean, I went back as far as Abe Lincoln and the assassination that happened there, of which the person that did it said, I did what I thought was best. And then you had some periodicals that wrote that the Almighty God has ordered this event. And I mentioned that in terms of the periodicals, and I want to kind of compare that to or make a note of what our guest there, Dan DeBar, said, that the New York Times, as a media or a print media, is also lending a hand in the way that things become polarized by drawing that type of analysis. So are we looking as that as being something that has happened from way before and is just continued throughout the decades in the U.S.?
Well, not quite. I mean, first of all, the Lincoln was assassinated at the very end of a civil war which claimed 600,000 lives in a country at the time had about population about 24 million. So, you know, it was a bloody, bloody war, a huge war, and it culminated with the assassination of the leader of the Union forces. But after that, you know, things died down. There was little of that sort of thing in Washington. But beginning in the 1960s, 1968, we saw a series of assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy. We saw the assassination of JFK in 63. But there's no doubt that passions have been heating up since the 1990s in a new way. The machinery of government is breaking down. We have had gridlock, an absolute deadlock in Congress for 30 years or so. Nothing can get done, and the less that gets done, the more frustrations rise on either side, and the more poisonous the atmosphere becomes.
Give us some examples.
Well, you know, I mean, Newt Gingrich shut down the government on two different occasions. They impeached Bill Clinton for the crime of having a sexual, you know, engagement with one of with a White House aide. You know, each of these things, you know, sort of raised tempers to new levels, and there was no way of resolving these things because the angrier Republicans got, then the angrier Democrats got, and the more Congress stopped working. Uh-huh. The American government is based on this bizarre 18th century system of checks and balances. Basically, you have to have three or even four major institutions agree before anything can get done. That's the House, the Senate, the presidency, and the Supreme Court. And if each of those bodies has veto power. So what you found starting in the mid-90s was that that Congress and the presidency were vetoing one another constantly, and nothing happened, nothing got done. And the more of a stalemate you had, the angrier people got. And then the angrier they got, the more they dug their heels in.
I see.
You know, so the process is kind of self-fueling. And so tempers are now shooting upwards. We'll see what happens on the election on Tuesday. But I think that there's no doubt that the basic governmental functions in the U.S. are hanging in the balance. And American democracy, such as it is facing a major crisis. I mean, I rarely agree with Joe Biden about anything. But in this case, he is correct. The country is facing a major structural crisis.
Well, Don DeBar, since our guest mentioned the midterms, looking at what the latest is on Joe Biden, who has obviously made a point to call upon the midterms and says, basically saying that, you know, this is something that is chipping away at the U.S. democracy, and that you know, we can't, this shouldn't be happening. Why is the midterms going to be a reflection of this, in the sense that Joe Biden is painting that picture? Do you agree with him?
He has to paint that picture. First of all, look at Biden's own numbers. His numbers are the lowest for any sitting president since the day before Nixon resigned. That's a fact. And it's been that way for a good while now. He needs some sort of a distraction, or they're going to lose both houses, and he's may well be impeached. That's a fact also. Let's start with JFK, who was assassinated in November 1963, Malcolm X, who was assassinated in February 1965, Martin Luther King in April of 1968, Robert Kennedy in June of 1968. In each case, security forces inside the United States have at least been implicated if they have not been held responsible. Okay, if we look further, if we want to talk about political violence, hold the picture of Muammar Gaddafi after he was run with a spear or a gun with a knife on it, whatever you call it, a bayonet. And the words, we came, they saw, he died. That's out of Hillary Clinton's mouth. I don't know how anyone can be sanctimonious about political violence when that's their team. Mm-hmm. This is something, again, and you asked, I missed it, because when we talk at the same time over these, you know, media, I can't hear when you, et cetera. You asked when H.R.A.P. Brown said that violence is as American as apple pie. And it was in 1967. So that's in the midst of the assassinations that I just ran. You know, we've seen political assassinations all the way up to an attempt today where they tried to kill Imran Khan. I'm guessing, if you find a dirty hand there, if the assassin, the attempted assassin, actually the assassin, because he did kill some other people, if they actually get him to trial, you may find out that the U.S. had a hand in that. Or look at Dugina, Dugin's daughter, that assassination. Certainly the U.S. or the U.K., the Ukrainians, et cetera, had a hand in that. This is political violence. This is real political violence. The attempts on Castro's life, you know, over the course of his time in office in Cuba, the attempts on Nicolas Maduro's life. I mean, this is U.S. policy. Sure. Why suddenly is a guy with horns a major threat to the U.S. democracy? I don't understand it. It's so absurd.
It is. And perhaps, now we're talking about the international arena and how the U.S. acts regarding that, but we're focusing on the U.S. here, so we have to go with that line for this program.
Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were domestic, and so were the two Kennedys.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Okay, to expand further on what Joe Biden said there, Daniel Lazar, which is what we're getting at here in some sense, or what I'm trying to get at from you, is the fact that political violence, according to the U.S. Biden, U.S. President Joe Biden, he has said that it is undermining democracy. And he says, make no mistake, democracy is on the ballot for all of us. Do you agree with him?
I do, actually, yes. I mean, first of all, let me say that Don is correct. I mean, the U.S. has pursued violent policies abroad, you know, for decades. And the assassination of Qasem Soleimani is just merely one example of U.S. policy. But the U.S. domestically has been kind of sort of a democracy all this period, and that matters too. You know, people can speak their mind. I can write whatever I want to without worrying about police breaking down my door. And elections have been in general kind of decided in a fair and democratic manner. But that is breaking down dramatically. I mean, Joe Biden's speech was classic Joe Biden. Joe Biden doesn't admit that the American system, as it presently exists, is falling apart before our very eyes. So it isn't that the Republicans are doing this single-handedly. The Republicans are merely like, you know, acting in response to what is plainly a systemic collapse. American political institutions are 235 years old. They have never been subject to a fundamental overhaul. The system is so old, so out of date, so unresponsive to the needs of modern society, it's not funny. And yet the system is so frozen that any kind of reform is impossible. You know, so we have an electoral college, a Senate which is unrepresentative. We have a Senate which is grossly unrepresentative. In the Senate, a majority of the population lives in just 10 states that are outvoted by the minority in the other 40. In the House, which is supposedly more Democratic, Republicans have enjoyed a 12 or 14% advantage since 2010. And now in the Supreme Court, Republicans have an unbreakable 6-3 majority. And they have, and that majority will persist for probably another decade. They have got a free hand to do whatever they want in with American society, and the Democratic majority is powerless. So Americans live under a minority dictatorship, and that dictatorship is growing.
That's an interesting way of putting it. Americans living under a dictatorship. Well, Don DeBar, based on what Daniel Lazar there said, are we looking at a solution which is far-fetched, but then again, is something that could be put out there, and that is a reform, which I think Daniel Lazar said a reform is not even possible at this point, that you need an overhaul, I guess, of the whole system, so to speak. I mean, is that something that, but is that feasible? Is that realistic to look at it that way? And is that a cause of what we call, one of the outcomes being a political violence that has been part of U.S. politics and mainstream the mainstream average Joe on the streets there in the U.S.?
First, I'll agree in part with what Daniel just said about there being a systemic problem. Some evidence of that. I did a Google search for illegitimate president and qualified it before 12/31/2019. Hillary Clinton, here's a headline from the Independent in the UK. Hillary Clinton says Trump knows he's an illegitimate president. There's quotes and such. Former President Jimmy Carter says Trump is an illegitimate president. That's from Vox and NBC News. He lost the election, and he was put into office because the Russians interfered on his behalf. You know, this has been going on certainly since the 2016 election in depth. And let's not forget that there were mobs. There's no, you know, if what was outside the Capitol was a mob on January 6th, 2021, there were mobs on Inauguration Day in 2017 and lots of other occasions like during the Supreme Court appointments of Kavanaugh and others. This is something that I agree that there's a breakdown here. What I don't agree is that the solution is going to be somehow to redo the Constitution because it's 235 years old, because the first question that arises is who exactly is going to be in charge of that process. Because the real problem is that there is power that is much greater than the construct of that 235-year-old Constitution that sits on top of an empire around the world. And that is who would be handling the rewrite of the U.S. Constitution. And my guess is that the first target would be the Bill of Rights. And so, you know, we have some serious structural problems. The structural problems that we have is we have the largest military in the world. That's a bipartisan effort. You know, I don't know how you vote for democracy in the face of that when each party does nothing but increase the military budget and the reach of the military across the planet every time they're voted in. That's the problem that we have. I think our structural problems are a lot deeper than the old documents.
Sure. Well, the problems are so deep that there's not many, but there are some publications out there, Daniel Lazar, that have even mentioned. Daniel Lazar, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, great. There's been talk about dividing the U.S. along the red and blue states. I mean, there's even been talks of that. So is that how deep this problem of political violence is, that it needs to go in that direction? I mean, we've heard about that
There's even been states that have said that they want to separate themselves from the U.S. But then overall, what about that approach? What's your thoughts on that?
I don't think that approach will work. I mean, that's a neo-confederate.
Not that it works, but what do you think about the fact that it went there?
I think it shows how polarized things are and how the country is splitting up geographically as well as ideologically. There's no doubt about that. But listen, you have a 235-year-old system, and the idea that you can't touch this, that it is not subject to a democratic overhaul, is ridiculous. I mean, how much longer can people put up with this? Another 200 years? I mean, you know, would you want the same government in Iran that you had in the late 18th century? Does Russia want to go back to the age of Catherine the Great? Does France want to go back to the age of Louis the 16th? This, you know, the American government actually dates from the final years of Louis the 16th. And it has not changed fundamentally since.
Uh-huh.
This is a complete absurdity that people don't realize, even Americans don't realize, how profoundly conservative and backward their political system is.
Okay.
It's remarkable.
Well, the political violence has reached proportions that could be called epic, Don DeBar, if you agree or not. But there's also been this... coverage that some are saying may result in a civil war, that the political violence, because of a surge, a civil war is not so out of reach, and that is exaggerated. Is it?
I think a civil war is being stoked, certainly. I don't think that the contradictions that exist materially in the United States actually lead to one. There are some astroturfed ideological differences that induce that kind of polarization. I mean, this has been the tradecraft of the CIA around the world. And look at all of Latin America. Even look at the attempted color revolution in Iran recently and the things that happen around the world like this. They go in. They have a media that divides the population, and they fight over things that are insignificant. A major policy is made behind the scenes. And,
okay.
You know, the fact that I don't understand what the process would be,
sure.
The democratic process would be in the United States to amend the Constitution, because I don't understand what democratic institution would conduct it.
Very well. I'm sorry I got to jump in because we're just out of time here. Don DeBar, I do apologize.
Together.
I'm sorry. We're just out of time. Activist and commentator Don DeBar, there, journalist and author Daniel Lazar, thank you so much for your contribution.
Thank
and with
you.
That, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitahue and the team, it's goodbye until next time.